Welcome to Radio Edutalk, and apologies for the slightly late start. Delighted to welcome to the first show back for the new series. Delighted to welcome to the show Tom Bennett.
Nice to speak to you, David. I feel like I've come home listening to your voice.
those who are regular readers of Tess or Tess Online will no doubt be aware of Tom's writing, and maybe for those who don't subscribe to that particular magazine, could you just give us a kind of introduction to your sort of career in education and what you're up to presently?
Yeah, sure. I came down to London from Glasgow about 20 years ago, and I was working in, I was running nightclubs in Soho for about 10 years, and then I became a teacher, as you can imagine, it was a natural transition. And I was teaching for about 4 or 5 years in the East End of London, in some pretty poor areas, in fact, one of the two poorest boroughs in the UK. So it was pretty challenging stuff. And I first of all kind of got into writing about behaviour, mainly because my own behaviour management was so bad. And I tried to fix that as best I can by going on as many courses as I could. And I found that a lot of the behaviour management training I'd had was really bad. So I started writing about that, and the TED started picking up on it. And I started to blog. And one thing I would say to anyone out there who wants to get involved in writing about education is just start blogging, just write it, do it for the joy of it, and, you know, don't wait to be discovered, just write, you know. So I wrote for the TES for a few years. I've been their behaviour advisor, I've been running the behaviour forum, doing a regular column and running a lot of their online stuff as well when it comes to behaviour. So I was doing that for a while, and still working full-time as a teacher. In fact, I still am a teacher. And then a few years ago, I started to get involved in educational research, which is, a lot more interesting than it sounds. I think my main problem was that when I first started teaching, I'd been given so many, how shall I put it, very dubious educational theories, which had been backed up by what people told me was really solid research. And of course, when you start teaching, you trust the people that are training you. And if they say to you, oh, this method of teaching and learning is the most effective, or this method of behaviour management is the most effective, you kind of assume that by now, in the 21st century, we've roughly figured out what we're doing. You know, we've got mobile phones and we can put people on the moon. You know, you think we know how best to run a classroom and then train teachers in that. And what I found was a lot of stuff I was being told early on in my career just didn't make sense in the classroom. I've been teaching for 10 years now, which, you know, so I'm neither a veteran nor a rookie. I mean, in 2004, when I first started training to be a teacher, I was involved in something that's called the Fast Track. It's a wee bit like Teach First is today, only it wasn't a cult. And on this route into teacher training, I was taken away onto residential courses and trained on things like neuro-linguistic programming. I don't know if you've heard of that, David. NLP.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Brain gym. I think a lot of people have probably heard about that. And lots of other stuff like that. And thinking hats and Bloom's taxonomy and all the things that multiple intelligences, all the things that, you know, almost every teacher I know has heard of and, you know, probably uses in the classroom. And I started to kind of wonder, how do we know if these things are actually true or not? Or has somebody just made it up? I was lucky enough to have a very understanding head teacher, and he let me do a sabbatical for a term. And I won a fellowship to Cambridge University, and it was really nice. I was like kind of a teacher fellow. And all I had to do there was I hung out with the Department of Education there and talked to people and read journals and read literature and just kind of wrote papers about what I thought about education. And that started to trigger something in me. And I noticed that a lot of educational research, and I'm going to choose my words carefully here, was utterly guff. Was utterly, utterly guff. And by that I mean was complete speculation, rhetoric or opinion, dressed up as science, dressed up as research. A lot of your listeners, and I'm sure yourself as well, will be familiar with Ben Goldacre, the doctor who wrote Bad Science a few years back.
Yeah.
It's a great book, and I also read that several years ago, and that also kind of catalyzed me, because one of the things that Ben Goldacre talks about is that even in the natural sciences, you know, the chemistries and the physics and so on, you'll get a lot of people who are essentially charlatans and snake oil salesmen, and they'll be trying to, you know, flog their product, or at least flog themselves, on the basis of dubious science. You know, they'll make claims that, you know, this pill cures that, or you know, they've discovered room temperature fusion or fusion reaction or whatever. And it's surprising enough to find that people do that, although, of course, when you understand the kind of money involved in things like, for example, pharmaceutical companies, you can understand why people make up science occasionally. So that was one thing. And what I noticed after reading Ben's book was that the same problem existed in the social sciences, but multiplied by 10. You know, they had it in spades. So if there are a few quacks and dodgy researchers in, you know, the physical sciences, there are a lot more of them in the social sciences, which isn't to say that social sciences are unfounded, which isn't to say that social sciences aren't useful. But what it does say is that there's a lot out there which people are saying is solid social scientific research, you know, educational research. And it's just not. It's just not. It's advocacy and rhetoric. And so what I did was, sorry, I'm going on and on and on here, but just stop me if I'm boring you. But what I did was I went back to some of the claims that I'd read early on in my career. Ben Goldacre does a really, really good expose of Brain Gym. And I kind of wanted to do a similar thing, but for other things that I'd learned about in teaching. One of the things Ben exposed about Brain Gym is that Brain Gym is full of this completely quack science. One of my favourite bits is that they say that in Brain Gym, which if you're not familiar with it, is a series of exercises and physical techniques designed to aid thinking. It sounds kind of semi-plausible, and that's the danger with this kind of pseudoscience. There's a grain of truth in it, or there's a grain of plausibility in it. It's not completely rubbish. And in Brain Gym, one of my favourite things is they say that you need to hydrate your brain as much as possible so you can think clearly. Well, for a start, the brain stays pretty hydrated anyway. You'd have to be seriously dehydrated before, you know, your brain function starts to be affected. And secondly, Brain Gym advocates that you absorb that water through the roof of your mouth. You're supposed to hold the water up against the top of your mouth or your tongue, you know, because it's closer to your brain. You know, this is the kind of rubbish which is being propagated. And we can laugh at Brain Gym now, but in 2004, I don't know a school that didn't use it.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Or a school that didn't contain teachers that thought this was cutting-edge stuff, right? So then there was stuff like NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, the so-called science of success. There was things like learning styles, you know, VAK. And this is something which I'm not so sure about Scotland, but I know in England, everybody thought was true, that you could discover a pupil's individual specific cognitive learning style. And it might be visual, it might be auditory, it might be kinesthetic, you know, or there was a range of other ones. And then what you were supposed to do is you were supposed to try and find out what the learning styles were and then teach to that preference. And that apparently was supposed to accelerate and aid the learning. Now, learning styles have been around for decades. And even decades ago, when learning styles first came out, in any good scientific community, you'll get peer review and you'll get people looking at other people's claims and seeing if it's true or not.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
Then, people were saying, you know, this is pish. Pardon my language. But the sheer attractiveness of learning styles meant that it just lurched on and on and on and on, even long after it had been completely discredited. And it has been completely discredited. There is no scientific evidence whatsoever for learning styles. There is no scientific evidence, not only for that, but there's no scientific evidence that teaching in a way that prefers a certain learning style aids children in any way in their learning. So there's no evidence whatsoever, which isn't to say that learning styles has been proven to be untrue. It just shows that it has not been proven in any sense whatsoever. There's a big difference there, obviously. And yet, I go into a lot of schools. I do a lot of behaviour training. I do a lot of research training. And still, I still see so many schools with big VAK posters on the walls, or in the lesson plan that will say, you know, VAK has been catered for by tick, 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 tick. And it just, it breaks my heart, all these teachers up and down the country basically wasting their time on this this pseudoscience, this what Richard Feynman would call cargo cult science, because it looks like science, but it's not really science at all. And the thing about VAK is visual auditory kinesthetic. You know, you never get anybody trying to teach for the olfactory learners or the, you know, the gustatory learners, the people who learn through taste and smell. You know, but that's kind of by the by. So learning styles is another example of that. And basically, you see in education a lot. Hardly a day goes by in which I don't read something in the papers about, you know, intervention X will help children learn better. Intervention Y will reduce truancy. And the thing I always advise people to do is just follow the breadcrumbs, follow the evidence, go back, read the paper, find the paper. Don't just read the article in the newspaper. Find the article that it came from, find the paper that it came from, and ask yourself, does it come from a journal? Has it been published, or is it just somebody's pamphlet somewhere? Because a frightening amount of educational research is just something that somebody put on the internet one day. Right? Another lot of educational research is stuff which is essentially PR puffs from commercial organizations wanting to achieve some kind of advertising or notoriety for their products. And so that's the first thing you do. You look to see, you know, where does this research come from? Has it come from a reputable source? Has it come from a source with some degree of authority? You know, for example, a university or whatever, that's a good start at least. Or has it come from a source that you might tend to think has already got some kind of inbuilt kind of bias to it? Anyway, I seem to recall about 100 years ago you asked me a question about what I'm doing. Can I just gather a wee bit and just, I'll finish that thought. I don't know where I went with that one.
No, it's fascinating, Tom. It's I think really healthy words for any for listeners in Scotland, you know, the start of the new school term. Certainly,
I'll do my best.
Really enjoyed listening to that part of your talk. I better say, Tom, you know, we are broadcasting live this evening, and if anybody's got any questions or comments for you,
Train is waiting to take your call.
You can get in touch in two ways. First of all, you can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. That's edutalkr. And obviously you can contact Tom on Twitter. He's got far more followers than Radio EduTalk. But if you pop the hashtag EduTalk into your comment or question on Twitter, then we'll be able to pick that up this evening and put it to Tom in the next 15 minutes or so. But
Tom, you better get in 15 minutes, otherwise that's it. You're dead. I'm out of here. I tell you, David's paying me £1,000 a minute for this. That's the only reason I'm doing this. Thank you,
Peter.
I'm very grateful.
Well, listen, Tom, where does Research Ed fit into all of this thing?
Because yes, you know, I knew there's something I wanted to talk about. That's right.
Because I mean, it seems like such a positive sort of introduction into the educational landscape, and you know, there's the conference coming up soon, and it sounds like it sounds like a place where there'll be many critical voices, but also one that might be worth going to if you're a classroom teacher or other educationalist.
Thank you. Oh, I hope so. Okay, Research Ed. So I told you before I was having all this problem with research. So I wrote a book called Teacher Proof. And it was basically just me trying to exercise the demons a wee bit. It was like bad science, but for education. And I wrote about just, you know, a chapter on every kind of myth which I'd encountered in education. And it went down really well. It was my most successful book I've written so far. And then one day I was multitasking. I was watching G.I. Joe, I think it was, and I was tweeting away. I think I was live tweeting G.I. Joe, you know, the glamorous life of the international blogger. And I was involved in a conversation with Ben Goldacre again, and Sam Friedman, who's a really good guy I met, who works for, he's a director of research at Teach First, and he used to be a civil servant in the Department for Education. And they were just talking about science and education, and it's obviously a subject close to my heart. Sam said that we should have a conference where people can talk about this, and then suggested, Tom, why don't you do it? And, you know, anything for a dare. I said, yeah, of course, I'll do it. And it just went bananas. So I put on Twitter, yeah, I think I'll put together a conference about educational research. I didn't get to bed till about 2 o'clock that morning with people tweeting me saying they wanted to help and they wanted to come. And I woke up the next morning, and I must have had about 200 or 300 emails from people, and the same number of tweets, from people saying they wanted to help, from schools saying they wanted to host it, from sponsors saying they wanted to help pay for printing and marketing and all the rest of it. It just went bananas, and people were saying, oh, we'll come along, we'll help for nothing. Speakers wanted to participate. It was almost like, and I can't take any credit for this myself, it was almost like it was just waiting to happen, and it just needed somebody to say, aye, let's do it. So that was, I think that was like April, May of last year. And I put a conference on in September, so like 4 or 5 months later, in the very lovely Dulwich College, which, if you don't know it, is a very, very nice posh school in London. And, you know, again, I was flabbergasted that they were delighted to host it for next to nothing. And we got about 500, 600 people, and we had a waiting list of about 100 or 200 people. And I got people, academics from Oxford University and Cambridge, and people from Scotland, even as far as Scotland. And we got hundreds and hundreds of people. Most of them were teachers. That's what I loved. You know, most of them were teachers or head teachers or senior staff, or there were people that worked in educational charities. There was lots of academics. There was lots of researchers. It was a really healthy mix. And so you got all these people face-to-face for possibly the first time. And academics were talking about their research, and teachers were talking about their experience of research. And it was this beautiful dialogue going on. And obviously because I was running the show and curating it, what I tried to do was I was really careful to try and get in academics who I thought were writing really interesting, credible research in this area. And it wasn't just stuff off the top of their head or stuff off the back of a matchbox. It wasn't just, you know, peddling their own pet hobbies. It was people who were really, really careful with evidence and really, really wanted to see if we could work out what worked best in classrooms. And there was a really healthy critical dialogue. I deliberately got in some people who I knew were quite critical of educational research. And that's good. You know, I want people to challenge it because good science challenges itself. Good science tries to falsify itself. And in fact, one of the things I think about educational research is that studying education can really help us learn how to be better teachers and run better schools. But we also have to accept that there are usually limits to how far the scientific method can help us as teachers. That, for example, when I am trying to calm down an angry pupil outside a classroom and I find out that his granddad's just passed away or something like that, there's no scientific principle by which I can work out what the best thing to do. That's when you've got teacher craft. You know, that's when you've got your experience as a teacher and the shared wisdom of the community. So basically, educational research has to tie in with that as well. There's a mixture of the two. And the conference went really, really well. And I put it to bed at the end of the day, and I thought, wow, that was the best day of my working life. I didn't think much more of it, but there was such a pressure to carry on. So I've started this organisation called Research Ed, and we've run two or three conferences since then. And it's just gone from strength to strength. I've done one in Leeds, and we've done one in York. And we're just about to have another national one coming up in September in a few weeks' time. And this time it's about 600 or 700 people, and there's another waiting list of about 300 people this time. We've got more names. We had Michael Gove coming.
I did notice that on the website, yeah.
No, hardly mentioned that. But he was coming, but he got shuffled out, so... You know, that's him gone. We've got loads and loads of other great people. We've got Nick Gibb, we've got Tristan Hunt. We've not got as many Scottish educationalists as I'd like, and the reason for that is just simply that the core base of people who've been interacting with me have been from the English system. But that's changing because there's been a lot of Scottish bloggers and Scottish tweeters and people on social networks who've been getting in touch with me. More of that in a second. So the September one's kicking off in a few weeks' time, and it's looking huge. And we're holding that in the East End of London. It's been sold out for months. I can barely get in myself, and I'm really looking forward to that. It's such a healthy, positive thing. It's teachers empowering themselves and making themselves research literate and making themselves better professionals by finding out for themselves what the research really says, rather than wait for somebody from your borough or the local education authority or the district council, or whomever, to tell you what they think the research says. Find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like the reformation of teaching. I love stuff where teachers create a quiet revolution for themselves, where it's teachers that are driving the change, because we get told what to do by everyone. Everybody bosses about it. Everyone tells us what to do. And, you know, often we just shrug our shoulders and go, aye, fair enough. But if we could make ourselves a wee bit more literate about what good research is and what research really says, we could become a bit more robust and a wee bit more literate against the people who just want to boss us around. Mm-hmm. And it's like a kind of a, you know, a Prague Spring. It's like this kind of like very, very soft velvet revolution happening. And the more people get involved in this kind of thing, I think the better and the healthier it is.
Mm-hmm.
So next year, we're taking it on the road, and we'll be doing one in Scotland.
That's fantastic news, Tom. Wow.
Well, I can't wait. Any excuse for me to come up and see my mom and pop.
Yeah.
if that doesn't make me sound like John Barrowman too much. My mom and pa. So it's most likely it's going to be in Glasgow. I've got some great contacts up there. Ironically, people I've never met physically. You know, people I've met online, which sounds a bit creepy, but people I've met through social platforms like Twitter and so on.
Yeah.
And it's just been brilliant. You know, they've been saying, hey, come up, you got to come up. We're doing one in Belfast. And weirdly enough, I've not told many people this yet, but it looks almost 100% likely we're going to be doing the one in New York next year as well. So it's just going from strength to strength, but my heart is very much in terms of the UK and doing this as a kind of travelling roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
And next month we also launch our website, which is going to be a place for educational news, a place for educational research to be showcased and discussed by, wait for it, not just academics but teachers as well. Teachers giving their opinion on research, mm-hmm. and how it works in their classroom. Because after all, research isn't some kind of, crazy language that only the chosen can understand, only the shaman or the priest. The research affects the classroom, and if it affects my classroom, then I'll bloody well have a say
on
whether or not I think it works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think is very important.
And I noticed on Twitter there, Caroline Creeby, I think it is. She loves your comment that Research Ed is all about the reformation of teaching. I'm just wondering though, where at the moment, Tom, where within your activities, where does the teacher researcher, the classroom based action researcher, etc., or practitioner researcher, which is a big, there's a big push for that within Scottish education and within the new professional standards. But where do they fit at the moment in terms of these large events?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that, David, because I've got some fairly strong opinions on that. Teachers need to get involved in research. To my mind, that's absolutely true. I don't mean every single teacher, but I think more teachers need to get involved in the process of research. Does that mean that teachers need to then go out and start conducting research in their own classrooms? And my answer would be no. Let me qualify that. To do good science is really, really hard. It takes a lot of training. And while I moan and rail about researchers telling me how to do my job as a teacher, it would be equally foolish of me to say that I can tell researchers how to do, you know, exactly how to do their job. Being a good researcher takes a long, long time, takes a lot of training. Most teachers don't have that training unless you have a background in the field. And what I would hate to see happen is for somebody to conduct a wee test in their classroom and, you know, for example, try out a new phonetics method in their class with 10 kids and run it for a year and then see how well they did. And then write that up as a paper. Because you could spend a lot of time on that, and that's not science. You know, you can't take 10 people and say, right, this I'm going to draw conclusions from it. What good science does, it takes thousands and thousands of examples and maps it across a long period of time and sees what effect your intervention has on it. Good science takes a long, long time. Most teachers can't do it in their own classrooms. What they can do, though, is they can hook up with large institutions that run research programs, like, for instance, you know, Strathclyde University or Glasgow University or, I don't know, University of Dundee or whatever, and get involved in their research programs and draw on their research abilities and contribute data for those kind of experiments. So that's the type of thing that I'd like to see happening a lot more. Or if you are part of a large, like an academy chain or a large chain of schools, if you pull all your schools together, you start to get the kind of size of sample that starts to become more meaningful. And if you then collaborate with, for example, University of Glasgow, and you get researchers in to A, conduct it, and B, set up the experiments, and C, analyze the data afterwards, that's a different matter entirely. But what teachers mustn't do is just think, you know, next week I'm going to start using Learning Hats with three kids for 2 weeks, and I'll see what happens, and call that research. That's not research. I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying the teachers mustn't do that. In fact, if you've heard of a thing called lesson study, have you heard of that at all? I don't know if it's just down here.
Mm-hmm.
Lesson study is basically, it's a way of examining you in practice. And basically what it would involve is you and another teacher picking three school kids and doing something with them, doing some kind of intervention, any kind of teaching thing you want to investigate, and then really closely watching what happens with them, and then trying to see if you can understand why what happened. Now, that's not the same as science. Science means when you can take your conclusions from that experiment and then say to other people, well, this could work in your situation too. But the lesson study, what I'm talking about, and which I think is a perfectly valid thing for teachers to do, is simply a process of reflection upon your own practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say caveat emptor. Teachers, don't go off into your classroom half-cock thinking, you know, I'm a researcher, because it's like putting tin foil on your head and saying, I'm an astronaut. You know, you're not a researcher, you're a teacher, and you should be a bloody good teacher. Hook up with researchers and get involved in research that way.
That's really interesting. I just wonder whether people come back with comments, you know, maybe after listening to the podcast. I mean, so you're really strong on the point, then, Tom, that, you know, that it would have to be a study that could be replicated, so you're looking at a large sample size. You know, it's not just being affected by the local context and such like, you know, the... I'm just wondering whether... I'm thinking of the Scottish context, whether Scotland's just too small. I mean, educational research within Scotland is quite a small concern. There's a lot of worries about lack of funding, and I know, yeah, you know, you're not working in Scotland presently, but is there also then an argument for, you know, Scottish-based teachers who are maybe more interested in what you're kind of terming proper scientific social studies, social research, to actually join kind of online networks and such like?
I would definitely say that Scottish teachers should get more involved. Whether or not Scotland remains part of the UK in the next 12 months is entirely up for grabs, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
But, whatever happens, I'm sure we'll all still love each other. There are a number of big research bodies in the UK, like the EEF and the NFER, and even organisations like the BERA. These are organisations that teachers can approach, or schools can approach, it's probably even a better thing to do, and get involved in research. Or better still, they can read their websites. I tell you what's a good website to look at, the EEF. You go onto their website and they've got something which is called the Teacher Toolkit. It's a summary of a vast number of educational research studies which have been corroborated compacted into our RCTs. They basically summarise all the best research, and they've got some really, really interesting findings, and I would advise Scottish teachers to look at that. I think Scotland is easily large enough for large studies to be done. You know, it's about 6 million people now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a huge number of people, and there's a huge number of school people there that you can investigate. But as I say, it has to be coordinated by organisations that have got that kind of sense of scale.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, universities are the perfect institutions. I'm sure that the Scottish Department of Education has got some plan different in this. I know very little about the Scottish system just now, which is ironic because I've been out for so long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a product of it, but I don't know what you're doing just now. I've been on very much the outskirts, and I'm very interested in finding out a bit more about your new curriculum for excellence.
Mm-hmm.
But and also the evidence which underpins it.
Absolutely.
But no, Scottish teachers should definitely get involved, and they should come down to things like Research Ed. And as I say, we'll definitely be doing one in Glasgow. I think one of my life's ambitions is to have a research head up in Orkney.
Oh wow!
one of my favourite parts of Scotland, and I'd love to see how many people I could get up there. But I think Glasgow would be a good compromise in terms of people getting there and travelling. Edinburgh might be another option as well, but you know.
Well, I think knowing some of the Scottish educators on Twitter, Tom, I think if you put something on in the Orkney, you'll get quite a turnout. I think the northern ferries will be packed out that weekend. Listen,
I'd love any excuse to come back to Scotland, but I come back as often as I can. Mm-hmm. I miss it terribly.
Tom, I'm aware that the time's getting the better of us. I'm just wondering, just to finish up, what are you looking forward to most out of the conference coming up in September? What do you think will be the key themes, well, as it stands with the guests that you've got lined up, or what might emerge?
Well, funny you mention that. You know, if I'm absolutely telling the truth there, the first thing that came to mind was, I'm really looking forward to 6 o'clock when it's finished and I can have a nervous breakdown after all the stress I've been going through. But the real answer, the positive answer, is that last year we started something. We don't know where it's going. We can't see the future. But it was nice to see it begin. And this year we've had a year. And people have gone away from the conference and people have gone to their schools and said, we want to get more involved in education research. You know, they've kind of seeded it in their schools, because we'll never get all the teachers to these conferences. But if we can send, like what I call research champions back into the schools who care about research and want to know more about it, and are willing to do a wee bit of work for their colleagues in their school and act as kind of champions of this kind of stuff, well, that's when you start to get an effect. And this year, we're having a meeting in amongst all of the, we've got about 70 sessions going on. In amongst all these sessions, we've got a meeting at lunchtime of what I call the research champions. These are people who've been given official roles at school to look after research at school, which I think is brilliant. And all these roles are different in different schools, but we're bringing about 30 or 40 of them together, and we're calling it the lunchtime of champions. And they're going to be meeting together in the room for the first time, and they're going to be advised by university professors and so on, people involved in research. And they're going to work out what their roles are, and they're going to share their ideas of what the roles are, and they're going to start creating a network of research champions, which I'm going to host on the Research Ed website. That's something that really, really excites me, this idea that we can see after a year what impact we've started to have on research literacy across the profession. It's really, really lovely to be part of that. It's such a positive thing to see teachers be empowering themselves and actually taking charge of their own profession for a change, because one of the things that always strikes me about teaching is that we've been so heavily stressed out by the very dogmatic systems of accountability that we've actually had some of the lifeblood sucked out of us, and we've actually been slightly deprofessionalised, that they've tried to turn us into a kind of a delivery mechanism for other people's ideas. It's nice to see us waking up a wee bit and taking control of our own lives and careers.
Tom, thank you so much for appearing on Radio EduTalk this evening. It's been great to have you.
David, huge anytime, mate. Give us a call.
Superb. And just, can you just point folk in the direction of Research Ed then? So if they want to find out more information, even if there's...
Okay. If you go on Twitter, it's at Research Ed 1. I know, catchy. Website-wise, we've had a few rough and ready websites over the past 18 months, because this was a very grassroots organisation. And the website will be launching in about 3 or 4 weeks' time, and it's www.workingoutwhatworks.com. www.workingoutwhatworks.com. That's kind of like the catchphrase, that's the slogan of the whole conference. and we thought we'd make that the website address as well.
Okay.
And so that's where people can find out even more. And if you want to find out about the September Research Ed Conference, just go on to Eventbrite, the bookings website, and just type in Research Ed 2014, and you'll find out all about the speakers we've got for this year's event.
Okay, and you talked about the importance of social media and different platforms.
Absolutely, brilliant. This has been how we've got bums and seats for this.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, and will it be kind of live broadcast at all, or blogged or tweeted about?
I've had my technicians and my wee technician elves have been in over summer, making sure that we could do two things. One, we'll be live streaming throughout the day. So we're going to pick about 6 or 7 sessions and live stream them onto the website, www.workingoutwhatworks.com. and then we'll be filming about another 30 or 40 sessions, and we'll be putting them up on the website once we've edited them and downloaded them, so this will take about a week or two, but we'll put them up as quickly as we can, so that the day itself can become a kind of a living resource, and that there's a legacy from the day, and people can go back to it and look and listen to what these fantastic speakers are talking about, and reflect upon their own practice a wee bit as well. So even if you can't make it, there's still a way that you can participate.
And we're talking about Saturday the 6th of September from 10 a.m. Yeah.
It's a day written tattooed to my forehead.
Okay, brilliant, Tom. Thanks again, and I'll just remind folk, if you want to follow up anything that you've heard tonight with our guest Tom Bennett, you can get in touch by email or pop something on Twitter with the hashtag Edutalk, and Tom is TomBennett71 on Twitter.
That's me, follow away.
Okay, best wishes, Tom, and I'll speak to you again in the future. Bye now.
Thanks, David. Have a great night. Take care.